You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Good morning, Nato Thompson. I'm speaking with the Chief Curator of Creative Time in New York. We have with us today Nato Thompson, who is the Chief Curator. Nato, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Nato, did I say that correctly? You're Chief Curator at Creative Time, is that correct?
That's what's on my business card.
And what does that entail exactly? What does that mean?
Well, it's, you know, this word curator, it's just devolving over time or evolving. But over here at Creative Time, we do large public art commissions. And so, you know, unlike a curator at, say, somewhere like the Met that deals with antiquities or things that already exist and their primary job is knowing the history of those objects, here we're dealing with objects or installations or performances that have yet to exist. So it's a very different job description. Basically, it's a somewhat, you know, it's a job that's predominantly about finding kind of artists that we think are doing the most important art of our times and working with them to kind of realize a sort of dream or a project.
Okay.
I know that's rather vague, but it's...
No, that sounds good.
Okay.
and we'll get into more details on Creative Time. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background. What was your first art experience? What got you into art, and maybe starting around, I don't know, whatever your first art experience was, or perhaps your first experience with art in school, up to now?
Well, you know, my parents are artists in the sense, I always think, you know, art isn't a thing you do. It's just a way of being in the world. I always think like arty. I had arty parents. And my parents had me when they were very young. So when my father went to grad school at CalArts, he got his MFA in film. We were really broke. So me and my brother moved into the dorms with him at CalArts in the early 80s. And that was a time where CalArts was famously wild and crazy, and the pool was clothing optional, and mostly installations were excuses to just have alternative housing in the school hallways. And so that was my first experience with real art, and it was kind of an epiphany that I realized that, you know, under some circumstances, adults could be cooler than kids.
And how old were you then?
I guess I was about 12 years old.
And what made you think, or when you went to school, did you go to school for art, or what made you think?
I went to undergraduate at UC Berkeley, and I had no interest in doing art. At that point, I was a fairly rigid Marxist, and I felt that art was a bourgeois activity for the leisurely class. And but I stayed in undergrad forever. I had no interest in going into the real world. And as time went on, I started having a art space with some, a kind of political space with some friends. And increasingly, we started doing more art programming in it. And I realized that the fusion of cultural projects with political projects was the most dynamic and productive and complex and interesting and exciting. And so I kind of slowly worked my way back towards aesthetic practices in undergrad. And then for grad school, I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and that was extraordinarily interesting for me as well.
And you were there majoring in what?
I did actually arts administration, which is not, it's a lowly title. There's no glamour in that, but my desire was to go back to Oakland and start an anarchist art space. But then I realized that most people that start art spaces are just trust fund kids, and I'm broke, and I didn't have any desire to write grants, so I had to hitch up my pants and realize I had to go get a job after grad school. So I went to the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art as an assistant curator.
Huh. And what made you decide that the making of art and producing of art was not a bourgeois activity?
Well, it kind of still is. I mean, it's, you know, it depends. It's, you know, there's no one world, and there's many tendencies out there. So it just depends on who you're working with and what their intentions are, of course. And you know, there are those out there that really consider art a kind of refined hobby, and there's, I'm not going to demean that. That's all right, you know. And there's also those that I think, come out of the kind of more political avant-garde traditions of art, which were historically very linked to revolutionary movements and giant cultural transformations of society. And in that spirit, I'm interested in who's kind of partaking in that challenge under a more kind of complex geopolitical arrangement where we're not all, there's no one avant-garde, there's no one truth, but there's a kind of interest of pushing art to including everyday life. And there are those people out there globally, worldwide. It's exciting. And all furthermore, culture is politics. One of the great curators on the more right wing side of things is Karl Rove. Karl Rove would never demean culture as a non-political agent. He's quite aware of the power of culture, and politics is cultural more than it is empirical. So there's a rich terrain to mine.
All right, that's interesting. To think about when after you became assistant curator, what brought you from that position to Creative Time? What was the space in between there?
Well, so I worked at Mass MoCA for 6 years, and that museum, if anybody's out there has been to it, is it's an amazing place, and you definitely should go. It's located in the Berkshires in northwestern Massachusetts, in a town called North Adams, population 12,000, and has these massive galleries and incredible, and they do a lot of commissioning work. They have a great fabrication crew on hand, and they work with artists to produce new works. And so I was able to kind of realize a lot of large-scale commissions with contemporary artists over my time there. And increasingly, I started doing stuff outside of the museum. And then Ann Pasternak, the director here, had been kind of pulling on my ear, saying, you should come to New York and work for us. You'd be great here. It's a great fit. And actually, I was fairly ambivalent because I thought New York City was the belly of the beast and that it'd be just this giant, weird art gallery cocktail party pretending to be life for the rest of my life. Nightmare. And it's not totally that way. It's all right now that I'm here. But finally, I lived in that town for 6 years, and I loved that museum, and I just couldn't live in a town of 12,000 for much longer. And so I was like, I got to go. And then Creative Time was also a great opportunity that scared me, but it was also exciting. And so I've been here for 3 years, and this place is absolutely amazing.
And tell me a little about your experience there. Why is it so amazing? What's exciting to you about Creative Time as opposed to your experience with Mass MoCA?
Well, the difference is just in terms of what it means to do public art, because a lot of people, when they think about public art, they just think of big abstract sculptures in parks, right, which is kind of called plop art. But what we really are is just not art in museums. That's all. And the more I'm here, the more I realize how much that really can be. And that, in fact, increasingly artists are working in ways that defy museological capacity. Artists want to work not just in public space on sidewalks or in parks or in malls or in stores. They want to work on net-based projects. They want to work on road trips across the country. They want to reinvent civic governmental projects. I mean, anything is material for artists these days. And we live in a hugely information age cultural society where we all, to some degree or another, participate in cultural production. So in a way, it's an ability to engage with the real fabric of everyday life. And all art is a way of tweaking us to make us aware of what's actually happening. That's the real artistic maneuver. So it's extremely exciting. We're doing the most important work, I feel like, and we're able to, we're not just working in New York City anymore. We've expanded to working across the United States, and now we're doing projects around the world, and it just keeps growing, and the possibilities are very magnificent. And just to also say, I don't want to sound so American, because, of course, the goal isn't to grow for the sake of growing, but to actually have political relevance to everyday life and to really take a step back and think critically about what we're doing as a culture. And I think art, on its best times, does that. And in its worst times, it's an elitist game. But in its best, it's a way of actually not being a commercial enterprise, but in fact, an opportunity to think. And that's what's the most exciting.
That's a great perspective. It's nice that that you're part of Creative Time. That sounds very refreshing to me, and I think to the art world in general.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about artist production. I'm sure you meet a lot of different artists. You said it was all commission-based.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm correct, does that mean that artists cannot propose or apply to Creative Time for projects?
It's possible, but I gotta say, we have a project process called Open Door where artists can come in, and typically we don't want it to be a pitch session exactly, but they could come to us with ideas they have about the public sphere or ways of doing projects, and we'll give them feedback. And there's a process for that, and we meet. We've been meeting about quarterly. Increasingly, we're partnering with different institutions now to do it. We just did it with PS1, MoMA, before their Greater New York show, and now we're working on one with Queens Museum. But that's one way we meet artists. And then we also work with specific artists that we know are doing projects. I mean, I must say we work with a lot of artists who've been doing work for a long time, so it isn't, you know, typically a platform for young artists that have never shown anywhere. Typically, we've had work with people who are a little further along in their career, but not like completely established, but not completely new either.
So in terms of your relationship to merging artists, that isn't really one that's created there. It is mostly somewhat established artists to mid-career artists.
Yeah, it depends. You know, sometimes we'll do these big group shows or projects. And, you know, I try to, it depends. I also have this thing called the Creative Time Summit, for example, which we organized last fall. And this is where different artists from around the world present for 8 minutes about various social-based projects. And we had very famous people like Tomas Firshorn and Suzanne Lacy and Maria Lind and Alfredo Yar present. But we also had unknown very young artists present as well with the same 8 minutes. And that was a way of trying to really kind of address the professionalization of the arts and to give everybody equal time and also kind of work across generations. So, you know, there are methods, but typically we don't do giant commissions with young artists only because you put a lot of energy in something, you want to know if someone can pull it off.
right, exactly. That's a good point. You know, maybe we should talk about that a little bit because that's very real. People being able to actually having confidence in the artist that they can pull it off. And one of the things that determine that is their history, of course, correct?
Oh, very much so.
So as artists are moving into the world and doing different projects, you know, some things now, I mean, and certainly it's a big part of the way I work is I have my own projects funded, do my own fundraising. Do you see much of that or a trend towards that, or would you suggest that for artists?
Well, I'm going to be very frank. I think the world is fairly awful. And, you know, when everyone says there's no funding for artists, there's no funding for this, I'm like, there's no funding for life in general. The economy sucks. We live under neoliberal capital. Everybody's forced into a condition of precarity. Everyone goes to school. And then they just have to, like, live the rest of their life paying off the loans to go to school. So, like, that is to say, the odds are stacked against everyone in general. And we don't have a culture that builds up much civic infrastructure to support the basic needs of expression that a society should have. So that is to say, it's a very unfair situation we're forced into. So when the options seem limited, that is a political struggle there. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm like, I just have to say that. I don't want to rant, but
That's good. That's good rant. I'm happy with that. So where do you think that does leave artists? So what are the options?
Well, so I think this, honestly. I think there's two really important things to do. And one is to find communities that you can plug into and work with other artists to plug into networks that don't rely on large infrastructural networks. And what I mean is, you know, you can knock on the doors of the major institutions forever, and maybe you'll get in. You know, maybe you could do everything right. You can get your images at the right resolution and do all those kind of, write the right grants, do all that. You can do it all the quote-unquote right way. But that's a very ungratifying way of living. I think the best way is to find people who speak and think about the world that compel you and work with them and find spaces that are, or start your own spaces that kind of allow you to do what you want to do. Because there's not enough time in life to not do what you want to do. So do it now. Make up ways. If you can't get a show, just make your show. Go get an abandoned space and do it. And don't do it alone. Go find people. Because it's just, it's because then you get legitimation and you get feedback and you participate in the production of a world immediately. And I think that's the most important part. Other things will come. But I always worry that, you know, if someone does it all the right way, by the time they get their break, they've all forgotten what they wanted in the first place.
Right. That's very inspiring, about essentially building your own community and creating spaces that's really operating almost as an outsider, certainly outside of the context that many people know and are taught to think of as the art world, correct?
Absolutely. And not only that, like, you know, say what you will about Facebook and social networking, it's got its tedium, but it is a way to produce communities discursively or like based on kind of ideas across space, right? And I'm watching, you know, there's this group locally called Feast, which is funding emerging art with sustainable tactics, and it's this collective cooking project where everybody that comes to this meal pays $20. Artists submit art proposals. Everybody that pays $20 votes on the best proposal. About 400 people go to the meal. So they raise about $4,000 or something, and then the artist that gets all the votes gets all the cash at the end of the meal. And that is, a self-sustainable alternative economy arts model that has nothing to do with the major systems. And these kind
that.
Of things.
What's that called again? Sorry to interrupt, but what was that called again?
It's called Feast. FEAST. And there's also, and that's in Brooklyn, but there's also one in Baltimore called Stew. And then there's another one in Chicago, which is, I think, the originators of this kind of model. They're called Incubate. And then there was a Feast started in Philadelphia. So they're spreading these kind of alternative funding models. And I think they're a way that artists can plug into a community immediately without having to go through all this crap of trying to play by the commercial game.
I love that, Nato. Thanks a lot. That's very interesting to hear. I think that's one of the most inspiring things for artists to hear. Is there anything else you'd like to say or talk about before we close this?
Sure. You know, artists get a bad rap in America. If you look on television, the classic cliche is that artists are aloof, elitist people that have no relevance to society. It's like, and it doesn't matter if they're right-wing or left-wing, everyone believes this about artists. And it's unfair and it's untrue. Sure, there are those that are like that. But let's face it. The one thing everyone's scared of is someone that actually expresses themselves and does something that actually means something to society, that challenges the status quo. And there are a lot of people that are into that, and we must support each other in really challenging the dominant narratives as a community that can express itself.
Thank you, Nato.
Right on.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.